by chance we're crossing the same roads all at one time. Even if you see it coming, no time to play out gracefully. One thing I know for sure, there'll be no doubt when you see you are. Grass make the heaven the middle of it. Grass make the heaven the middle. We are grass make the middle of it. Right on schedule.
The secret truth. Through forgiveness we awaken, transforming information and knowledge into wisdom. And now our co-hosts, Charlotte Littlefield and George Butler.
Coming up on this first hour is Alan Watt. And I interviewed him. This is a rebroadcast from October 14th, 2007. But it's a very, very good listen. It's about 49 minutes long. I cut out the commercials. But it was originally done on We the People Radio Network. And I had a program called World Review Commentary. So I'm going to replay and rebroadcast some of those programs, some of the better programs tonight. But this first hour is with Alan Watt. And it's a rebroadcast from, like I said, back in 2007. But what we do in this is we cover a lot of ground, and this is a good foundation for someone that's new to looking at the New World Order or the One World Government that is being, constructed and nurtured and promulgated right before our very eyes. Alan Watt is a Canadian by way of the UK, and he has cuttingthroughthematrix.com, and I'm going to also put up on this a click off to the script. He had someone prepare a script for this particular program, so I'll have that as a click off on this first hour. The second hour tonight, I'm going to be covering our current news, and there's so much scandals out there that it's it goes on and on. But anyway, this first hour is with Alan Watt. And he's quite a genius of a person. He's a musician, a writer, and a researcher. My gosh, he has quite a few talents. But and I'm going to click off on here on this first hour. I'm going to give you his website so you can go in there and look at his website. He's currently broadcasting out of Canada, and so you can listen to some of his latest programs on that cuttingthroughthematrix.com. Kid me. But this man has such a great overall view of anyone that Charlotte and I have ever interviewed. Now these particular programs on this particular program came out of a program that I produced myself. I would occasionally bring Charlotte Littlefield Brown in, but most of the programs you'll just have me interviewing someone. So that's what I did this evening. But anyway, getting back to Alan Watt, we cover all kinds of different. You can download this off of our site with an opposite click, by the way. So download this and listen to it again. This is on demand right now. We're working on relocating the terrestrial station that we normally broadcast on. So I don't have anything to do with that. I'm just waiting for those people to let me know when we can start putting that up again on the air. But anyway, we're going to be doing the on-demand here in the pod, you could say, cast here for several weeks. And now this second hour, I will go current with that, with the current news and so forth. So you can listen either way on-demand. These programs will be available after about 6 o'clock on Saturday afternoon. So you can come in here and click off on hour 1 or 2 and and they should be up and running and available for you to listen to. Off of the Texas Liberty Radio, you can also listen there, and there's click-offs on the home page there, so you can pick it up on that basis. Alan Watt is probably the most, I would say, in-depth person that I have ever interviewed. He has such a broad knowledge of this thing called the New World Order, or the, you know, international, the one world government, and so forth. He has insights on it, not only from the United Nations, but the different institutions. And what's interesting is going there on cuttingthroughthematrix.com, and there's some download there. There's some PDF files that you can download off of his site. And some of those PDF files lay out, and there are some British files there. The British, because of the East India Company that was established in 1600, I'll lay out just a little bit of history here. The British became dominant worldwide. They were shipping opium into China, and they were bringing back spices and stuff from the areas. And these were very valuable for the new emerging markets that were being formed in Europe, especially in the UK and England. There were other companies and corporations created after that, later, that would do slave trading into the Caribbean and also into the colonies, the newly established colonies, American colonies that the British had established and controlled. So the slave trading was out of course, London, and then also it was out of Bristol, England. Now, that's sort of a little tidbit of knowledge that not many people know. There's still a trading company there that's maintained by investors in Bristol. But they built up their enormous wealth originally through slave trading and so forth into the Caribbean and into the colonies. So that's just something that to keep in mind. These companies were not, the actual East India Company did not, as I understand it, do slave trading, but they had set up, the British investors had set up two separate companies. One, like I said, was located there in Bristol, England, and then the other one was located out of London. And these two different corporations that were separate and apart from the East India Company did the slave trading into the West. Now, we need to get a perspective of this slave trading. And this is what Trump is doing right now, and this is what's very disturbing to some of your higher ups, is that there's been a white market a trade in individuals and humans, a human trafficking trade, and the wealthiest people in the world and the richest people in the world are involved, and that's really where Trump is disturbing their new world order, and this is where he is unwanted, not welcome. In fact, they're plotting to get rid of him in a lot of different ways. But we must stand up behind him and give him all the support that we can. I want to thank everyone else there for listening to this first hour, and listen carefully to this interview that I had with Alan Watt, because it's very, very educational. And it has some good insights in there that are good preparatory type of information and knowledge for future study in this area. Thank you for listening. God bless you.
Welcome to World Review Commentary. This is your host, George Butler. Today we have Alan Watt. He's a fine guest. He's an author, thinker, philosopher, songwriter, and performer. Welcome to our program, Alan Watt.
It's a pleasure to be on with you.
I could have read your whole thing, but tell our listening audience, I've quizzed you on this before. How did you awaken? At what age did you start awakening to the truth and your journey towards truth seeking?
I really started very young when I was really toddling around before I went to school, even just by going through various people's homes and listening to their conversations and mainly their arguments between the adults, and it was always over money and basic things like rent and food and so on. And this was in Britain, that had ruled a good part of the world, and that's what made me wonder, how come, if that was the case, that only a couple of hundred families in London owned everything and the rest of the people did not? They owed nothing, really, in those days. So it showed me that there was some kind of rigged system on the go back then. And so I digged in. I got into the old history books, the ones that hadn't been tampered with so much, written before the 1900s.
Well, you're saying that before 1900, the year, the books were more authentic and they're more authoritarian and truthful. Is that your view?
Yeah, because you understand that most folk you see prior to that age, that era, had been pretty well illiterate. And so the literate class could publish many books for themselves. And since they were the ones who already owned the structure of Britain and its empire, then they were more candid about what they were doing. It wasn't until after the 1900s, especially after World War I, that they really started to alter history with each republication. They began to abridge books and literally, like George Orwell said, a lot of history went down the memory hole and simply disappeared from the regular books.
I was looking into Pearson, which is a British company, the other day, and they say in Wikipedia, I'm just going by Wikipedia, well, actually, I think I looked it up on some database, and they were saying that they're the largest educational publishers in the world.
Mm-hmm.
Does that sound right?
Yeah. It's very probable.
Prentice Hall, I think, is one of their main publishing houses.
Yes. That's right. And what we find today in Europe, especially in Britain and in the Americas and Canada, you have the same, there's not even a handful of main publishing houses that give you all of your educational books, because they want to standardize education worldwide, therefore it must all contain the same information or disinformation, because it's all done for a social agenda, not to educate you really. And so you have standardization of the educational system worldwide under the International Educational Association.
Do you think some of this, of course, is intentional, and then some of it evolved over centuries or millenniums and they're actually refining this system of hidden rule and control? You think it sort of evolved, and then some of it's really intentional too?
Some of it may have evolved. However, there's no doubt most of it is intentional. When you go again into the history books and you realize just how long meetings, world meetings in a sense, have been held comprising of the wealthy families and their control over their countries. Many of these families, even in Europe, are all related to each other, regardless of the countries they live in. And they cornered every market, including the educational market, and because they plan the society they want, they plan the next 100 years, 200 years. You don't keep power by leaving it to chance. You keep power by planning the future and altering the structure of society to make sure that you're always in charge of it.
There was one time that I looked at the Prussian education system, and there was one time after being defeated by Napoleon where they said, hey, we've got to educate a soldier citizen. Is that sort of like what you're saying, that they've actually created these soldier citizens to protect the wealth?
There's no doubt about it. Prussia was a big player, because Prussia and what became parts of Germany were really into the soldier idea, the soldier aristocrat and so on. And that's where they had the jewels. Everybody who was anybody in Prussia and amongst the elite had to have at least one saber cut on their feet, on their face, because they're always in these saber fights and duels. And that's where the whole militaristic idea for which led to World War One and eventually to World War Two came from was Prussia. And you find all the royal houses of Europe who are related together really trace their roots back to Prussia. You have the Saxe-Coburg-Gotha group in London, and they now call themselves Windsor. They changed the name in World War One because they had German names, and it wasn't very good to motivate the public to fight Germany when your kings and queens had German names.
That Saxe-Coburg relates back to the Guelph, House of Guelph, and then Velf. Is that accurate?
Yeah, especially Guelph.
Guelph is an old
it's an old word for wolf.
Oh, really?
That's where it comes from. And that's also where your name golf comes from, because all the high masons play on the golf course. That's where the deals are done. But Guelph, the Guelph families, you'll find if you go into the history of the Americas, the U.S. and Canada, you'll find that different place names called Guelph, Mansfield, Grosvenor, and so on. Now, that was because the British Crown gave these families charters to own huge chunks of the Americas, and that they still do.
Could you describe the system overall as a money, mind, sorcery? It's like they're practicing sorcery on most of the population, the masses?
Yes, there is no doubt about it. Sorcery, really magic, is a way to fool people by illusion.
So they're casting these spells and through as institutions of higher learning. They're using those too, aren't they not?
Absolutely. We think of education as being a way to give us skills to survive and compete. And that's part of this whole system of theirs is competition. We all compete. We're taught to from the beginnings of school. But education to them at the top is a way to give a more obedient or create a more obedient society. And if you go into the old speeches of Daniel Webster, he gives tremendous speeches about the U.S., and he states that quite openly, that the educational system that they have set up in the U.S. is to create a more obedient, compliant society.
Well, Mark Twain had some very cutting things to say about education, too.
Uh-huh.
And
yeah.
And he said it in his own way. I mean, he was so down-to-earth and commonsensical, you know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
And I forget one of the sayings. I'll put it up later. But he's something about the barrel of strawberries. At the top, it's okay, but at the bottom, it's rotten.
That's right. And he also talked about the myth of America, the myth being that if you just work hard, you get to the top. Then he goes into the little dialogue about picking up the pins at the bank and eventually the bank manager giving this little boy a job because he's so hardworking. And then the boy marries the bank manager's daughter. And then he goes into the real one, the real society, where the little boy picks up the pins, the bank manager grabs him, and then kicks him out with no reward at all.
Oh, man.
That's the reality opposed to the myth. Yeah.
I always say a bank robber robs with a gun, and these money people with a pen.
Absolutely. Oh, absolutely. Yeah.
And you know what? I used to think the bank robber was a criminal and thief. Now I think he's a folk hero.
Yes. That's right.
You know what I mean?
Oh, yeah. These characters.
I'm saying that tongue-in-cheek, of course. Yeah, I don't believe in robbing banks, but but they're robbing each other sometimes.
Once in a while, there's a little bit of competition there, as long as it's done with their own rules. But these characters, literally, I mean, I know people in Merrill Lynch, the investment company, and they told me how it works, how the Tokyo Bank is so many hours behind the New York Bank and all the rest of it, and how they can tap in. There's hackers all the time, inside trading. And they make millions overnight by transferring money, maybe two or three times, shifting it two or three times to different banks, depending on the interest rates, while they give the common investor a few percent back on their investments.
You know, one thing that I see between you and some of the great philosophers of the world and thinkers is that you bring some, you know about money and you know about the occult. You
mm-hmm.
know, they yeah. leave that out.
Yeah.
You take someone like Dalai Lama or something, they're all spiritual, and they're just pushing some kind of spiritual, you know what I mean, idea or worldview. But they leave out this money angle in this, you know, and the occult. I don't think you can leave those out.
No, I watched the Dalai Lama on a little documentary with one of his lesser employees, you might say. And I watched him touch his forehead to the top of this lesser's head and these old occultic rituals that they do. All the tops of the religions are part of the control. They control vast amounts of people. And those at the top are always brought into the real world, the world that runs the system here.
Well, would you say that there's a network then of people that really are clued in?
Absolutely. Absolutely. There's no doubt about it. Yeah.
And that's really when you're describing your own worldview, are the essence of what is real, true reality. Then you're describing a network of people that have mastered are masters of control and manipulation and mind wash and mind control, right?
Absolutely. Uh-huh.
And they use all the isms in the world to do it.
They do. They use all the ologies and isms, and they use all the sciences they can get a hold of. And that's one of the biggest pushes, of course, and that came from Frankfurt School and so on, the educational system of today. I think Gatto has a fantastic book out on the hidden or the secret forms of education for the Americas, but it was for the whole world, in fact. And it all came out from Germany in the 1800s, again, with Prussian guys on top who designed it. They wanted a compliant society, societies that would be the mass man. They'd act as a mass unit rather than individuals. And they said in their own writings they'd have to destroy individuality and the rights of the individual for a compliant society, a well-behaved, ordered society.
You seem to dwell a lot on individualism.
Yeah.
Because that's really the way that you nurtured your own view. Is that, would that be correct?
There's no doubt that the whole thing about school is conformity. From the day you go into it, it's conformity. It's all moving at the same time in gymnastics, doing the same thing, clapping your hands even when you're five at the same time. Repeat after me. It's all mass training. And again, that came from the old Frankfurt School. And the missionaries like John Dewey and all the others were sent out to bring this into effect. They said, as I say, that individuality must be destroyed. It was the only enemy they had towards this mass control, which they were looking forward to.
Because what you're saying maybe is that individuals could come to the conclusion that you have come to about the way it really works. So mm-hmm. They don't want individuals, right?
They don't. And they also knew that for every step of the agenda, which they had figured out a long time ago, there would be repercussions and eventually grassroots organizations would set themselves up. So they thought they could train the leaders before the events and they would start up the grassroots movements, their own opposition, and lead them round in circles. And that's what we have today.
You have a dialectic a maze of conflicts, of different groups fighting one another. Is that right?
That's right. To get something happening on a large scale in society, you've got to create a ripple that affects the masses. And you know, within the masses, there'll be someone who will set up an opposition to it. And if you set up your own opposition who says all the right things, eventually you come to a compromise between the two conflicting sides. The compromise is actually what you were after in the first place, because a compromise means that someone lost somewhere along the line.
Yeah, so in other words, someone's giving up, both sides are giving up their real principles.
That's right.
Or they're very, I got you. Their heartfelt views, whatever they might be, whether they're well-intentioned or not.
That's right. You cannot compromise a way of freedom. You can't do it. There's no such thing as compromising freedom.
You either have freedom or prison, right?
That's right. You have, yeah, absolutely.
Imprisonment, enslavement. I guess it can be said a lot of ways. And what you're saying is that these ideas form a prison, a matrix. Getting back to your site, tell us about your site, Cutting Through the Matrix.
Yeah, I've put up talks that I've done over the years going into the histories of the various groups and foundations that help fund all of this. And they can download from that site, Cutting Through the Matrix, hundreds of talks that help to fill in a lot of blanks that you don't get normally in school or in the media, for sure. And I try and tie it together and show you the how all of these groups are interconnected towards a common goal. And the goal is not pretty. It's pretty nasty. And I know most people can't really look at it too long because the bad news tends to overwhelm you. However, I always say that to get to heaven, you got to go through hell first, and that's what we have to do.
So there's an awakening process here that we need to go. We have to begin that awakening up to real truality. What is?
Yeah.
And that's hard to do.
It's very difficult when you realize. We have been going under, like Aldous Huxley said, a scientific indoctrination since we were born. We don't realize that. I mean, prior to television, definitely to radio, it was much harder to brainwash vast amounts of people in the same formula, by the same technique, to bring them all to the same conclusion so that they'd be of one mindset. But with the advent of radio, then television, you'll find that Huxley and Bertrand Russell, and many of the big players that were involved in the foundations, the think tanks, especially the ones in psychiatry. Psychiatry is a big player in this. They brought them all in, and the marketing companies that knew how to make or motivate people to buy were all brought together to condition vast amounts of the public.
Alan, we're going to have to take a break right now, but we'll be back in about 3 minutes. And could we get into some of that psychiatry? And there's a Frenchman, is it Lure?
Mm-hmm.
Can
yeah.
we talk about him a little bit too?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, we'll be back in about 3 minutes. Thank you, Alan. Welcome back to World Review Commentary. Let me say something, a quote from our guest this morning. His name is Alan Watt. Listen to what he says. This is a quote out of one of his publications. In all ages, in all lands, there have been those who seek truth. This seeking is an individual search for something more than self and much more than the confines of this worldly system. It is the seeker who understands there is more than what meets the eye, who is not afraid and makes the choice to go into the unknown. The process of awakening has begun. The discovery is underway. This was written 2007 by Alan Watt. Welcome back to our program, Alan.
It's a pleasure to be on.
Those are fine words. The technology angle here, like Kurt Lewin, did he introduce some of the early technology through Tavistock? And then there was this Frenchman that you speak about at times also.
Yeah, there were many of them, actually. The big one that we know of, you see, the idea was to, they knew and had meetings about this, they knew that religion was a big obstacle to bringing in a scientifically controlled society. And so they brought out Freud. That was a big one that they really pushed after Darwin. Darwin was also part of this, in fact, in his day.
Social Darwinism, something like that?
Yeah, Darwinism was to help to obliterate religion and replace it with a new theory, which is just a theory, although it's taught as fact, and that was evolution. And if everything evolved and there's no God, we're on our own, therefore those with the brains and the education should lead the world. That was the whole idea of it. But it was also to bring in an old idea, and that was eugenics, the better different types of species, subspecies, and so on, and the useless eaters at the bottom, heavily written about at the time of Darwin. Karl Marx wanted to dedicate his fourth or fifth republication of the Communist Manifesto to Darwin, and Darwin was advised not to, simply because he had to keep his distance at his stage in which he was based from the Communist Party. So they're all in bed together, and of course the Darwin family already was practicing eugenics because they only married for a few generations into the Wedgwood family. Every wife was a Wedgwood. So they were already practicing eugenics. They believed that through scientific breeding they could create a super race. This is where the whole idea of Superman came from, and the Germans took this up in World War II. The Soviets also tried to practice it on a different scale. They called it the Soviet man that they would create, and it's still ongoing today. We find through the writings of Aldous Huxley. Aldous Huxley's grandfather, remember, was the best friend of Darwin, And so you always find the same relationships and the same families doing the same part of their agenda, specialized agenda, intergenerationally. And Huxley wanted a brave new world type system where they would breed different types of humans, specially made humans for their particular purpose. And that's where we're all going today. It's been on the go nonstop from the beginning of the 1900s. And we find that the greatest mathematician who ever existed, Rutherford in Britain, he was the guy who did all the measurements for the pyramids and so on, hired by the Royal Institute, the Royal Society. He worked in his memoirs, his own memoirs, by the 1920s, he worked on genetics long before we were told they'd actually discovered the gene. In his own book, the man writes that he was employed to work on genes. Now, why would you hire a man who's a mathematician to work on genes if he couldn't actually see them?
My gosh. Transhumanism, is that a good term for our listeners to go in and look up?
Yes, that's the idea. But step by step, I mean, I used to wonder how could they bring us into a brave new world where you have different categories of humans from the elite all the way down, purpose-made humans. And I realized we're actually on our way. First, they introduced the computer, which they didn't have to give the public. Remember, they already had it for the military-industrial complex. They were the ones who ran internet sites amongst military organizations. They even had one set up with the Soviet Union so they made sure there was no mistakes, because they're all working apparently against each other, but at the top they're working with each other.
They want to coordinate their efforts, in other words. That's where the network comes in.
Yeah. And we find the people who worked at MI6, like Peter Wright, clued into this, that there wasn't just the Soviets with their KGB and Britain with its MI6. There was also a party above them that made sure there were no mistakes. They were all working together.
There's this thing called the semantic web. Are you familiar with that? It's a new level of the web, I believe, as I understand it. I have a very, you know, limited knowledge of this, where it's more database and databases interacting through a lot of different new languages with the user online.
I know about that, but what's even more important is this virtual world, this virtual. I always laugh at the word virtual.
Yeah, what does that mean? Tell us about that.
It comes really, again, it's a play on the old Masonic virtue. They always go into the virtues. Before you're a Mason, you have no virtue. Once you become one, you have virtue. And you have virtual, not quite reality, but almost reality, a different kind of reality.
Almost,
And we saw this with the 70s and 80s. They show you these big helmets on children as they were in their own little world playing a virtual game. And they put some machines, some of these virtual reality games, into I think it was Waterworld in Canada, where they have the fish and so on, the big oceanic fish. And they put one into Disneyland, or a few into Disneyland. And what they found was when you go into this virtual world, even for 10 minutes, you can walk up walls, walk across ceilings, and do all amazing kinds of things. But they found that when you came off the machine, jumped into your car, and drove away, almost everyone was driving into someone else.
Because
your brain had adapted so quickly to this.
Is this entrainment? Is that a technique, what they call entrainment?
It's part of entrainment. There's no doubt about it. Your brain will adapt so quickly to things which you could not possibly do in reality. And it cannot switch back immediately either. You have to relearn how to walk on the ground and drive a car.
Or drive a car, right?
And your spatial ability has to be come back to you.
God, that's insightful.
So these things are because they have. Now, the military-industrial complex, and I've got it up on my site, in cahoots with governments, are actually doing this. But they're collecting all the data from all Internet users, coupling it with census data and making a virtual you. One of you somewhere is in a computer system, and it creates a virtual world where they have your personality type, your likes, dislikes, what you do with yourself, your purchases, that kind of thing. They've got a substitute you already inside a computer somewhere.
You know, recently they've come out with this this scanner program that this American came up with on Wikipedia.
Mm-hmm.
Several years ago, I experienced that firsthand, but I didn't know what was going on. I was looking at a page, and then I went to something else, and then 3 or 4 minutes later, I came back and refreshed that page and went back to the page, and something was missing. A piece of the page that I looked at 3 or 4 minutes earlier was missing off the page.
Yes.
So so this is a continuous, contrived editing process to continue the rule, the influence.
There's no doubt about it. And with the new marketing techniques and the new way that they're leading us all into, they expect people to sit in their homes one day, and not too far away, actually. They could do it now. And you will appear to be in an office with other real people, but it's all the virtual people in the cyberspace.
My gosh.
Yeah, now when you couple that with the Matrix movie, that's exactly what they're creating.
Yes, the red pill, the blue pill.
You
know, what I experienced some of this one time, too, was that a friend of mine, I was putting together a production this summer, a musical I'd written, and I was talking to this girl, and she said, I have this pet. I said, well, what kind of pet do you have? She said, let me show you. She went to the web and showed me the pet that was in her virtual pet shop.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
We'll be back, Alan. Okay.
Yeah.
I don't have any virtual pets. Okay, we'll be right back. Thank you, sir. Welcome back to World Review Commentary. This is your host, George Butler. This morning, I have with me as my guest, Alan Watt, and I'm honored to have him appear on this program. Alan, welcome back to our program.
It's a pleasure.
We were talking about a virtual reality. All these kids are into virtual gaming and stuff, and that's just gone too far. What do you think?
Well, the point of it all is to bring us step by step into literally a Matrix-type world, a world where you will be a battery, an energy source, and you'll be used by those at the top. But it's also it blurs, in fact, it totally confuses what is reality, what is normal, what is abnormal. Today in this system, they try to tell us there's nothing abnormal, if you notice. There's no good, bad, or evil. There's only the end result. So any emotional tag they put to it is a human judgment. And that's sort of successfully, pretty well, eliminated right and wrong, good and evil. Once they've done that, they can then bring forward the next step, and that is literally the purpose made human. The ID also means ideal design. That's another little side meaning of ID for your ID card. They want to create ideally designed humans, and this was written about in Huxley's Brave New World. He was put out there to, on the one hand, give us predictive programming. When you follow stories, especially fiction, that have thrills in them and they're fascinating and lots of science fiction in it, you don't realize you're being programmed towards something which will eventually happen in your lifetime, and you accept it far more readily when you're familiar with the idea, especially when it's been presented through a fictional work. And that's called predictive programming all the way from Tavistock. And that was the job of Huxley. And we can go as far back as Plato, who was a member of the old Greek aristocracy, who wrote the book The Republic. And Republic was to be a utopia for this guardian class where all the common people beneath them were purpose-made and bred for their particular job.
Well, you can tell the people in the network because they're Neoplatonists. Is that why they subscribe to that? I guess they do.
Absolutely, absolutely. Neoplatonism came out really in Alexandria in about the 2nd century A.D., and they had schools in Alexandria where they coupled the old mystery religions of Egypt and tacked it on to the talks that Plato gave, and that's called Neoplatonism. And you'll find every big player who's ever existed, the Huxleys, the H.G. Wells, again another propagandist for them, they always refer back to Plato and the Republic, where the goal of the guardian class, especially the ones who had special selection, would be fulfilled. And they said that if they could breed people like animals, if you want a tall, strong apple picker, you simply breed him with a tall, strong female and keep interbreeding their offspring until you get what you want. So they equated the people to cattle and to animals and domestic animals. And that actually has been tried down through many centuries in different countries. We found that with the Zulus. Chaka the Zulu was approached by British, you call them agents if you want, or merchants, it doesn't matter, they were both one and the same at one time. And he eventually formed a tribe by slaughtering all the shorter people and only keeping those over 6 foot alive. And they interbred them until they had the giant ones we call the Zulu today. So eugenics has been practiced widely in the past. The elite have always practiced it. Priesthoods used to go through genealogies, very important to them for certain traits, certain qualities. And what we find is that today we have an elite running the world. The elite families of the world are basically psychopaths in nature. They don't have that normal human attachment to other humans.
Is that a genetic thing, or is it learned also? Is it learned behavior and genetic, or both?
It's both. You see, the psychopaths, when they exist and they run the system, and this system is meant for the psychopath. It's only the psychopath who can get to the very top of any system here. They do it through cunning and manipulation and the will to destroy anyone who's in their way. They have no conscience.
Well, this money operations acts as a great dynamic of a barter field.
Oh, absolutely.
To create this synergistic system of rule, of hidden rule, would that be a fair statement?
There's no doubt. This is the psychopath system. This is not a natural system we live in. And from the earliest days to the present, since money was created, we've been run by psychopaths because they gravitate towards power. The psychopath has an exaggerated craving for power, total control. He is a control freak, or she, doesn't matter. And they've been specially bred down through the ages, these wealthy, successful families who generally got their money through plunder. But when you go into even the Yale Society, Elihu Yale, who set up Yale before the Revolutionary War, said that regardless of what happens in the future, all the leaders of this country will come from here, and therefore they will continue our agenda.
It seems like that they have seized upon this money, a monopoly of money creation, and that's a really main controlling mechanism. Would that be right?
Yeah, we forget there are many ways that humankind could have come to this point, but we've been directed along one system since 800 BC. Actually, before that, in 800 BC, they coined money for the first time before they weighed it. But money and lending money and interest and all of this kind of stuff is very, very old, and as far as money goes back in any form, you'll find the psychopaths have ruled it. They are the natural con men. A psychopath has certain gifts as well. They don't have to be tremendously clever, educational-wise. However, they are naturally streetwise. They see the con immediately, and they're able to exploit it.
These psychopaths and these individuals, the megalomaniacal, whatever, however, you know, these are terms to describe. Is it the abstractions that they're able to seize upon that are wrong-headed and actually wrong, that they support what's wrong in them? Is that, would that be one way to say it?
Yeah, this is the thing. You see, the ordinary person, when you study the psychopath, the ordinary people, what you should say about the psychopath? The psychopath damages those around them, but not themselves, because they don't worry about anything. They don't have the conscience of a normal person. So the fallout generally is taken up by families around them or people around them.
So they can practice this physical dominance and ruthlessness without any conscience.
Without any conscience. And they form, you see, a psychopath is able to recognize other psychopaths intuitively. And long ago they formed clubs and associations, Richmond's clubs and associations. And they themselves, they view themselves as being the natural successors to the world, because they are the most successful financially. They're willing to be vicious when required, to have wars or start wars, to get agendas through and slaughter millions of people. So So they see themselves, and that's why they push the Darwinist theory. They see themselves as the most highly evolved species on the planet, as being predators, and they're very proud of that. They say that, in fact, Darwin himself and also General Albert Pike said, we have no shame in saying that we follow nature and nature's laws. And by that they meant, if we equate them to animals and the higher predators, then they are the natural successors. They're the highest predators.
And then this feeds, this is reiterated by Darwinism, or whatever.
Yes. Oh, absolutely.
And then, yeah. Oh, I got you. And then man is the animal, right?
Yeah, and so you have lessers and the higher animal. And the lessers are all the people who follow. They are the alpha ones who lead. So they're very proud of that. And they really do push the whole evolutionary theory because it substantiates their stance on why they are where they are.
You know, this kingship was a divine right. How would you describe their... How do they come about their rights, that they are the intelligent people that can guide the world to this new whatever madness?
Yeah.
Is that sort of the illusion or the delusion?
That's exactly it.
They think themselves as gods. Is that sort of another?
Yes. Oh yeah. I mean, divine right meant that. You see, they have their own occult. So you understand the occult. You understand them. Their little religion there, and the way that all religions were set up, you had a hierarchy in heaven. And therefore you had a hierarchy on earth, like a mirror reflection. You had the king at the top, the advisors and the lords and the cousins, all the way down to the local laird. And then you had the peasantry. And so it was modeled on this idea of a heaven above and the reflection below. And the divine right of kings, people used to come up to kings like King James, and if you touched their clothing, they were taught you could actually be healed. So they were like walking gods.
They believed
that, yeah.
And this just continued that ego state, that super charged ego, that megalomaniacal thing, that the glorified self, I think Karen Horn and I used to describe it that way.
That's right.
They think of themselves as glorified gods.
Yeah, blue bloods. Yeah.
Blue bloods. We're better than the little masses. The masses are a bunch of dummies out there. We're going to manipulate them and use them, right? We'll be right back in about 3 minutes. Thank you, Alan. Welcome back to World Review Commentary. I'm your host, George Butler. Welcome back to our program, Alan White.
It's a pleasure to be here.
Do we exist in a field? Could you look at this from a field theory? Is that sort of the way you look at it at times?
I know it's been pushed, this unified field theory idea.
Yeah, what about that?
We're all interdependent and so on, but I don't really believe that at all. That's the big key of it. You find the UN and everyone else is pushing interdependence. It's a mandate, in fact, to do with globalism. And it's not true. We exist with each other on certain rules and regulations and terms. And you either exist as a mass group with all the same opinions, the mass man, or you exist as individuals with their own rights and freedoms and ideas and opinions, and you accept and tolerate that in others. It's one or the other. If the individual loses, the game is over. The mass man will simply go into the next step, which is the purpose-made man. You'll accept that quite readily. It's only the individual that ever changes the world.
So we get back to individualism again. Versus this collective, are the real movers and shakers creating a collectivist fascist world government?
It's actually here. Most people don't have opinions of their own. The greatest tool that Huxley said was television, and Brave New World Revisited, and he said through television that they could propagate so much disinformation and information and bring everyone to the same conclusions and opinions, a standardized human being. And that's what you find in society whenever you go out to hear. And this was also reiterated by Brzezinski, Zbigniew Brzezinski, Between Two Ages. He said, shortly the public will be unable to form an opinion by themselves. They'll allow the media to do it all for them, to do the reasoning for them. Well, that's happened with most people. He also said that the only conversations you will hear shortly are reiterations of the previous night's news, And that's what you hear when you go out. Everyone's talking about what they heard last night on the news.
It's information, informing, huh?
Informing, yeah.
And they form you into this parrot, right?
That's all people really are. They are parrots. Even with debates on politics or whatever, they always have one or two experts, again, a world run by experts.
Oh, I love those experts, don't you?
Yeah, and they come on after a politician speaks, and both will interpret it in a completely opposing way.
So they'll spin it like they want, right?
And Joe Average, you see, they know this, that Joe Average will pick one or the other, and that will become his opinion.
That's the dialectic. You know, what I found very common out there is if you quiz most of these college students or graduates or something, and you ask them the question, is truth relative? They'll say, yeah, truth is relative.
Mm-hmm. That's right.
Almost inevitably, you'll get that answer just like a parrot response.
Yes, and again, that was promoted through school from the beginning with them, moral relativism. And if you go into Kabbalah, it's very important to understand the Kabbalah, because you'll find that the top Hollywood producers and so on, all the Hollywood crowd, they're all into Kabbalah. They even send their children to the Kabbalistic schools. And I think Madonna even sends her child there. And the Kabbalah, they don't believe is right or wrong or good or evil. They're told to equate it like a line going from left or right. And it just depends on how your human view looks at past events, even if it's mass slaughters or wars, and look at the outcome. Was it good for a certain few of society, or at least for some of society, or not? So good and bad are irrelevant to them, as the same with good and evil. And I did hear an interview with some of the top horror and sci-fi writers, and they were all asked the same question: do you believe that such a thing is good or evil? And they all gave the standard, a classic Kabbalistic response. There's no such thing. There's only the human view on past events.
So it's a subjectivist view that they've been nurturing and pushing. No,
yes.
Objectivism. They don't want that. They don't want a real objective view, do they?
Not at all. Once again, objectivism comes from individual responses and individual thought.
Now, the interesting thing you said in the past is where you have to experience it directly. The more directly that you experience reality, the more truer opinion you're able to form. Is that something that's valid?
Absolutely, absolutely. When you stand outside or walk amongst them, almost like an alien observing society, it really smacks you in the face how conditioned it is. It's all conditioned responses. You walk into a store, you have a nice day, did we find all we wanted, sir? And all these classic conditioned Pavlovian responses that trigger you to then respond to them and say, yes, of course. And that's what they're doing. You're being trained through other people who in themselves are conditioned to give them also Pavlovian response.
I'm okay, you're okay, everything's okay, nothing matters, there's no good or evil, and just do your own thing, right?
That's right. If you went to a store, and I do this, and they'll say, how are we today, sir? They're all told to say this, and it's automatic, like, have a nice day.
Have a nice day, sir.
I said, you really want to know? Or I'll say, it's been hell.
How about have a lousy day, sir?
Yeah, and you'll snap them out of their conditioning for a few minutes. Yeah.
Well, you can put that on them and they say, what? What did you say?
That's it. Uh-huh.
You shock them into reality.
Shock them back into it, yeah.
But jokingly, right?
Yes, and it does work. It does work.
Because they'll say,
smile.
What? What is that? Because they've never heard that. They're conditioned to that normal, typical response.
That's right. Everything is Pavlovian training. From when you enter your car and that little buzzer sounds for your seatbelt, you're being trained by a sound to respond in a certain condition.
And there's an insurance company that's going to minimize their payouts, right?
That's right. Yeah. Uh-huh.
So it's money operations we get back. The temple bankers, right?
The temple bankers, yeah. The trapezius, used to call them.
And they were priests, too, so they practiced mind wash on the public with religions and money dominance on the... You know, on the farmers.
Yes, yes, they did. And that started thousands of years ago when priests used to bring in the seed. Everyone had to give seed to the temples. And eventually the priests caught on to the fact that they could ask for X amount back plus surplus. That was interest.
So the percentage over and above what they had borrowed from the temple was the considered to be the interest.
Regardless of the growing season, good year, bad year, whatever.
Well, interest to me, look, is a fictional idea that was created to dominate the space-time continuum.
Yeah, interest.
That's
is
what
a
I say.
Thing. Yeah, it truly is.
It's an invention.
So is money. See, money itself was an invention.
Yes.
This is the old allegory to do with Eden. If Eden was perfection and you leave Eden, there's only one road out of it where now you have to survive in a wild world, which isn't too hospitable at times. And you're on the road to science, where man, through his own will conquer and subjugate and overcome. But it's a road of science, and this particular road has one ending, and that is the elimination of conscious thought for the majority of the public, because those at the top must have it that way.
So is that the new religion then?
It is, yes.
But it sounds so good and so logical. Is that the way they're presenting it at times?
Yeah, absolutely, absolutely. Guys like Arthur Koestler, who worked for MI6, put a lot of science fiction novels out there again, and also many non-fictional works, and worked for the United Nations too. I wrote a book called The Ghost in the Machine, which is your mind, by the way, your individual personal mind. That's what the ghost in the machine is. And he said we must eliminate that by any means possible, the individual part that makes you, in order to gain world peace.
Is this a madness that is being promulgated and nurtured and projected and created through institutions at times onto the population?
There's no doubt. It's from the.
It's
the
not
top.
Sane. It's an insane dynamic and thought and process, and seems like to me the way to describe it would be that way.
It's diabolically insane.
Yes, it is.
Because it's incredibly cunning. They do have the data of observation of populations, behaviorism, that have collected over a vast amount of time, and they know they can pull this off. They can train the public like a huge herd towards this final giving up of your individuality. And if they give you enough stress, enough worries, enough hype, a faster pace of life, then and offer this as a way to escape, maybe even temporarily, that's how they'll first push it. Better than the movies, better than tranquilizers,
and
then most folk will go for it, you see.
Like breeders of hate.
Yeah.
They breed hate, and they don't want any forgiveness in there at all, do they?
No. No.
So we've got the forces of forgiveness against battling the forces of non-forgiveness, and the non-forgiveness is of the world.
Yes, you are dealing with strange powers here. There's no doubt about it. We're dealing with people who project wars in the future and plan them 100 years ahead sometimes and train troops to go into covert wars like the School of the Americas to slaughter millions of people.
Yes, they reinstituted that and changed the name. I can't even tell you the name of the School of the Americas anymore, but it's still there.
It's still in Fort Benning.
Yeah, it's Fort Benning, Georgia, but it's got a name that's, God, it eludes me right now, but it's still there. But they kicked them out of Panama.
Yes.
Way back, and that's why they went in there and took out Torrijos, it looks like. That's what John
that's
Perkins
right.
says
that's
in
right.
his Confessions of a Economic Hitman. We
yes.
had him last week, and he testified that Torrijos was taken out because he went against the School of the Americas.
Yeah, they wanted the U.S. to stop interfering in Latin America.
We're going to be right back and take a real short break. It's just a minute break at the top of the hour, and then we'll be right back and continue this conversation. Thank you, Alan.